Hi, I'm David Crow, and this is episode 241 of The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Listen Tuesdays at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time or on prn.fm, or subscribe to the podcast. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990. Another phone number, 862-800-6805, is voicemail. Leave a message or question for the show, your name, and indicate that the question is for The Infectious Myth. If you dial either of these numbers, long-distance charges may apply. If you want this show to grow and improve, I suggest that you commit to a monthly donation at patreon.com or liberapay.com. There's a lot that I could do if I had some funding to travel to conferences, to hire an engineer, etc. If you want the independent media to thrive, it's incumbent upon you to put your shoulder to the wheel, to put something into it. And a little money for this radio show or other radio shows or podcasts that you really like is something you really should think about. The world is obsessing about the new coronavirus scare from China. I don't have a lot to say about it right now, except the only thing to fear is fear itself. A few years ago, I wrote a chapter of my yet unfinished book on SARS, which was also blamed incorrectly on a coronavirus. The parallels are simply incredible. I have put my chapter online at theinfectiousmyth.com/book/sars.pdf. with SARS in all uppercase. You will learn that it was high-dose steroids and the nucleoside analog drug ribavirin and perhaps other drugs that caused the high death rate. You'll understand why the death rate was higher in Canada and Hong Kong than it was in China, which has especially in those days, had a less developed healthcare system. Even the more invasive forms of ventilation were associated with worse outcomes. In the end, the world got tired of it after only a few months, and the epidemic mysteriously disappeared. It disappeared because doctors stopped testing. I will write more. But now, our guest. Dr. James Lyons-Weiler is returning to this show for the second time. He's the founder and CEO of the Institute for Pure and Applied Knowledge, also known as IPAC. He's author of 57 peer-reviewed publications and has written and published three books, one on Ebola, another on cures versus profits, and a third on the environmental and genetic causes of autism. Along with other scientists at IPAC, he performs research in the public interest aimed at finding ways to reduce human suffering using funds donated from the public that are raised at IPAC educational events. His research program is currently focused on aluminum toxicity, autoimmunity, and the differences in health outcomes between highly vaccinated and unvaccinated children. Welcome back to the show, James.
Thank you so much. How are you, David?
I'm good, thanks. I'm looking forward to talking to you again. There was a recent World Health Organization vaccine safety conference. It was very interesting because it was all of these experts on vaccine safety in a room by themselves with nobody on the outside listening, except it was all taped, videotaped. So what they said is now part of the public record. And there was a vaccine safety expert who said something about adjuvants. He said, you know, a lot of vaccines don't work without adjuvants, but the first rule of using adjuvants is don't use them. And the second rule is use the safest one. But I think there must be a third rule that is, you know, if none of that works, then just use whatever gives you an immune response. And a lot of adjuvants these days, I don't know if they all have aluminum, but a lot do. And you've written two papers recently, one in 2018 and one in 2020. And the one in 2018 basic summary is looking at a safe level of aluminum in the body, especially of children. And the second one, my summary is that it was looking at the retention of aluminum in the body. So let's go to the 2018 paper. And, you know, we know how much aluminum is in vaccines. So does that not tell us whether the vaccine is safe or not just from that number?
Okay, that's a good question. So yeah, the World Health Organization held this vaccine science summit And in the vaccine summit itself, there were a number of speakers, Dr. Marion Gruber among them, and we'll get to the names of each one as we go through, but they covered a lot of things and they said some astounding things that you know, it's hard to say they're taken out of context. There's the only appropriate context is, you know, if you say things like, you know, that the man that you referenced, we'll play his thing here in a minute, but he teaches courses and he's actually telling the world in the World Health Organization when I teach courses that because of the reactogenicity of aluminum adjuvants and other adjuvants, you know, if you can get away with not using an adjuvant in a vaccine, do that. And if you can't get away with it, then make sure you test it in combination with a total sum of adjuvants that a person's already exposed to. And, you know, there's this mentality because pediatricians are never taught toxicology, they're never taught anything about vaccine safety other than they're safe and effective. Now go save the world. That as long as you have four arms and a pair of buttocks and a, you know, you can vaccinate, you know, five, six times, one individual five, six times. And it would be nice to know that the vaccine adjuvant amount in each vaccine is truly a minuscule amount. And that's a qualitative, minuscule is a qualitative claim. It's not a quantitative claim. And so at the Institute for Pure and Applied Knowledge in 2018, we undertook the question, what is the safe dose limit of aluminum injected into children? And, you know, it's a very straightforward question, which leads to the question, well, first of all, has the FDA ever published a pediatric dose limit for aluminum for vaccines? Mm-hmm. And when you look at the aluminum dose limits that are discussed by the FDA, there are three of them. The first is 4 to 5 micrograms of aluminum per kilogram per day from parenteral nutrition. This is IV-based nutrition, parenteral meaning going other than enteral, other than eating, you know, right. Non-ingested. Mm-hmm. And 4 to 5 micrograms per kilogram per day for people with renal insufficiency. So they're not able to, you know, clear aluminum that's in the blood out of the body through the kidney very well. And this was found out accidentally by having too much aluminum hydroxide in dialysis solutions, because aluminum is generally regarded as safe and the dialysis solutions actually blow people's kidneys out. And so they set a limit.
Wait a minute, dialysis is supposed to save your kidneys.
Yeah, it was a mistake. There was too much aluminum in the product.
Okay. Right?
So 4 to 5 micrograms is an amount. 4 to 5 micrograms per kilogram considers body weight. That's kilograms of body weight.
Let's emphasize that. So if you know an amount of something, you cannot say that is safe in everybody, because people vary dramatically in weight, from say a neonate to a husky adult male to a malnourished older person, right?
Absolutely.
By doing it by kilograms, you're to some extent normalizing the data, right? Like, there's obviously other differences in people, but it's certainly a lot better to start with the weight of something per kilogram than it is to just say, okay, here's a pill, and everybody from a baby to a 350-pound weightlifter can take the same pill.
Correct. And so body weight being an important factor, people just think about anesthesia. You're not going to use the same amount of anesthesia for a whole body anesthesia for your 300-pound weightlifter and a 7.5-pound newborn baby. So,
right, let alone a preemie.
Right.
Is another problem.
So we were talking about 4 to 5 micrograms as an amount, and then per kilogram being body weight, and then per day being the time component. So there's three measures, 4 to 5 micrograms per kilogram per day. And what we found was that the FDA had that limitation for parenteral nutrition. And then they also, in the NICU, you mentioned preemies, preterm infants, they have a limit that's not really a limit. The FDA has a publication, US FDA has a publication that says that it's okay to vaccinate children when they become 2 kilograms of body weight. They don't say that it's not okay to vaccinate below, but they say that it's appropriate to vaccinate before. It's very passive. And this passive aggressive nature of regulations from FDA isn't consistent with any real concern over safety. It's easy to misread. a lot of people in the NICU might not know this. A lot of NICU directors might not know this. And in fact, since I started working on aluminum toxicity, I've gotten calls and had long conversations with nurses in the NICU that thank me for what I'm doing because their directors actually have them vaccinating everybody. The directors actually have the audacity to call for the crash team with respiratory and with cardiac kit carts standing by so that they line up all the infants in the NICU and they vaccinate them at the same time because they know some of them are going to go to respiratory distress, some of them are going to have a heart attack, and so on. And so they know what's going on, but they're following protocol and they're not thinking. And they think, well, the vaccines are so important. It's so important that we have vaccinated against these infants in the NICU against hepatitis B. And it's ridiculous because the infants are not going to be exposed to any source of hepatitis B unless they have a mother who's hepatitis B, and they're always tested, so we know which mothers have hepatitis B. They have a sibling who's got hepatitis B or somebody else in the family, which is very rare, or they're having sex with prostitutes and sharing needles.
Which presumably is going to be a few years down the road.
Right. And so this is one of the most ludicrous, you know, positions that we have on the vaccination program, in my view. And so we looked at the question of, all right, what other limits do they have? I told you about the 4 to 5 micrograms per kilogram per day for enteral nutrition. And I told you about the 2 kilogram limit. By the way, an adult rat weighs 1 kilogram. So as long as you're twice the size of an adult rat, you're a human being, you're going to get 250 micrograms of aluminum. And so I could not find, we could not find, the research team at IPAC in 2017 when we started the project could not find any expressed dose limit for vaccination in the pediatric schedule anywhere that resembled the 4 to 5 micrograms per kilogram per day, which you would expect something like that. It might be 14 micrograms per kilogram. It might be 2200. Who knows?
They're comparing then dialysis, which is injected into the body with a vaccine that's injected.
Right. So the route of administration is the same, but an IV goes into the vein and the aluminum-containing vaccines go into the muscle. So there's a different body reaction to it, but it's still technically parenteral. There's not a third category for it. So you're getting a substance or a compound into your body that doesn't come through the through the alimentary canal or through the digestive system.
Okay.
Okay, so we couldn't find any dose limit. The only dose limit that the FDA said was that for any vaccine, the limit is 850 micrograms per dose if it's measured one way, or it's 1150 micrograms per dose if it's measured the other. And so we're looking at 850 micrograms in vaccines as a limit, but infants in the NICU have a 250 microgram. And so there must be some scaling function that they tried to scale to bring down, you know, the 850 micrograms. So we did this huge deep dive into figuring out how did FDA come up with the idea that 850 micrograms is a safe dose. And that it's okay to express it 850 micrograms per dose, not per dose per kilogram per day, but per dose.
Okay. Yeah, which doesn't make sense, especially since so many vaccines are aimed at children that over, you know, say a 14-year period go from a few pounds to, you know, a couple hundred pounds in some cases.
Right. So what we did was, since we couldn't find one, and then we looked at the determination, couldn't find a limit. So we looked at what information went into the determination of this 850 micrograms, assuming that 850 micrograms has anything to do with safety. So we read the entire literature going way back, and we found that there were two committees. The early committee was a World Health Organization committee. The next committee was the ATSDR. It's out of the CDC. The ATSDR looks at toxic substances in toxicological profiles. It's the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registries, part of the CDC. And it was founded just in time to make a statement about aluminum and vaccines. What had happened was that the World Health Organization had, you know, a provisional tolerable weekly limit for ingested forms of aluminum. That is, that there's aluminum in food. It's considered generally considered safe by the FDA when it was founded. It's in things like, you know, baking powder and so on. So they had a one I think it was 1,000 micrograms or 1 gram per week for, you know, an adult.
1,000 micrograms or 1,000 milligrams? Because 1,000 micrograms is just a milligram.
Yeah, yeah, right, right. So it's 1,000 micrograms. You're right. So 1,000 micrograms, I believe, is it. And you just recently read our paper, mm-hmm. so you'd be up to date on that. But the we published the whole provenance on it. And then that works out to a certain amount per day ingested. And then we know from the results from the University of Kentucky, Yokel's research, that we only absorb 0.3% of whatever we eat. Mm-hmm. So considering that level of exposure, then ATSDR looked at it and came up with this other amount of two. They doubled it, basically. They doubled the amount that you could maybe expect to be safe in diet, right? And so...
Why did they double it?
I think that it's suspicious. I believe that they doubled it because they were trying to find a way to excuse a large enough dose in the vaccine to get a reaction.
I mean, normally with safety issues, you put in a safety factor, right? You reduce.
We'll get to the safety factors and all this. Okay. Remember, we're just talking about ingested forms of aluminum. We're not talking about injected yet.
Yeah.
And so it's like I said, it's convoluted and it's complex. But so we're looking at the ATSDR, which doubled it. And so we asked, why did you double it? You know, we went to the literature. And what they did was they cherry-picked a specific study. It's the Golobadol study. And they said the Golobadol study had a fairly large dose of ingested aluminum, and that study didn't find anything, no adverse events from this at all. And in reality, that study did find adverse events. They had problems eating. They had to delay some delays. The CDC ignored a bunch of other studies that had much lower doses that did have a problem. Okay. So if you study the provenance of this, then it seems like they arbitrarily chose this amount. And the problem with that then is, okay, that the FDA based part of their safety assessment in a paper entitled Mitkus et al. By the FDA, where they used data from a model called the PRIEST model. That's like a clergy, a priest model. Mm-hmm. There were six or seven adult men that were injected with radioactive aluminum hydroxide to measure the rate of whole body clearance. And so they came up with a clearance function. They added to it some of the knowledge from the oral doses in adult mice. And they transmogrified all of that information into an assessment that says, okay, 1,000 micrograms in an injected form is probably safe for an adult. Because the data were from an adult. There were six or seven, you know, adults that were used in two studies for the clearance data. And so they ended up saying 1,000. Well, the 1,000 makes 850 sound safe. And I think that's why they chose the Golobadol study. The Golobadol study was one of the factors. Mm-hmm. And so they had other problems with aluminum being fed to mice. And there's serious problems. There's learning delays, problems with behavior and gait problems. And this is all published in our papers that they ignored. They ignored all the rest of the literature showing that there was a problem. And so the World Health Organization, Expert Committee on Food Additives, and the ATSDR were actually at odds with each other. They disagreed on the total amount. So the 2011, with the revised provisional tolerable weekly intake of 2 milligrams per kilogram was, and that's why I didn't get that right, it was 2 milligrams per kilogram from that. Then the ATSDR simply said 1 milligram per kilogram per body weight per day was a reasonable safe limit.
Which is a 2-to-1 safety limit.
Right. So we're looking at a big problem here where the ATSDR in 2008 just came up with a number that made you can vaccinate every day at 850 micrograms if you can eat 1 milligram per day, right, per kilogram per day. So in 2017 and now in 2020, the Code of Federal Regulations just regulates 850 micrograms per dose, but it doesn't regulate the number of doses that you get. So right. on makeup days, on the CDC makeup days, you can get 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 vaccines at one time. And it sounds crazy that they would do this, but they actually do this. I've met parents who said that my child had serious problems after getting it. I mean, the mice had neurotoxicity. They had impaired kidney function. They had brain inflammation, learning and memory impairment, and impaired spatial learning just from eating aluminum.
Okay, well, let's emphasize that point. So the rational way to measure aluminum or some other substance is, you know, in micrograms or some other unit per kilogram per day. And that would mean if you wanted to have 6 vaccines in a day, you'd have to add up the amount of the aluminum or whatever else and make sure it was under that limit. But what you're saying is that it's a single number that does not take into account whether you have a very small child that's, you know, maybe small for their age, and then you have a bigger child. And then you've got the limit for one vaccine, and then you're saying if it's okay to have 850 or 1,000 or 1,150 or whatever for one vaccine, you can do that 6 times, which is going to be 6 times your limit, which makes right. no sense at all. Like, why have a limit? You know, you can only punch me so hard, but you can punch me 1,000 times. Like, yeah. It makes no sense.
Right. And so on the first dose of being 250 micrograms, and then you skip a month on the US CDC schedule. In the second month, they get a total of 1,225 micrograms. In the third month, they get 975 micrograms total. In the fourth month, they get 1,000 micrograms total. Then you skip a month with no aluminum-containing vaccines. And then you get, it looks like 800, and then skip a month, and then you go 875. And so what do these numbers mean? They're just numbers, 875 and so on. So we took, in 2018, we took the FDA's assumption or conclusion that 850 micrograms per dose is safe, and we're still just talking about per dose, and we said, okay, if that's a single dose in, say, 150-pound male, let's say, mm-hmm. right, then what would it be? Is there any way to scale that down? Is there any reasonable, widely accepted function that's used to scale it down for infants, like a 7.5-pound or 3.3-kilogram newborn male? And so we did this, and we came up with a pediatric dose limit curve, which was scaling for weight. So we're doing the FDA job, right? So the FDA didn't do this. We did this, and we published that pediatric dose limit. And then using the same model, the PRIEST model of clearance that the FDA relied on for the MITCUS study, we then modeled the total vaccination schedule with successive doses of aluminum in the first 2 years of life.
And over that time, the child normally would be growing very significantly, right? So you would be measuring the weight at various ages. Each time they get vaccinated, they're a little heavier.
Yeah, and our equations take into account the body weight. So we're looking at the clearance rates, and as the infants are getting larger, the dose limit actually, the clearance rate assumes the body weight of an adult. Let me clarify. This is very important. We're going to have the best case scenario where we assume that the infants are clearing the aluminum at the same rate as an adult. So the clearance rates are actually optimistic. The pediatric dose limit is body weight corrected. So even if they could clear aluminum the same rate as an adult, and we know that they can't because newborns only have 20% glomerular filtration rate. Their kidneys only have the capacity of 20% of an adult. And they're not until about 2 years old when they have 100% glomerular filtration rate. With this optimistic modeling, assuming that infants clear aluminum from vaccines at the same rate as an adult, we estimated in our 2020 paper that the infants are going to be in aluminum toxicity 70% of their days in the first 7 months of life. In other words, they exceed the whole body burden of our pediatric dose limit 70% of their days up to 7 months of the life. And now this period of time is a very essential period of time for neural development.
Right.
Very essential time for other development, like the immune system, immunological development. And so they exceed this pediatric dose limit under the CDC plan 70% of the time. And under Dr. Paul Thomas's vaccine-friendly plan, where he excludes some aluminum vaccines. He skips some others, and he swaps out one brand of aluminum-containing vaccine for a type that doesn't contain aluminum. We estimate that we can expect infants up the first 7 months of life under Paul Thomas's plan to only experience aluminum toxicity 5% of their days. And that's a huge difference.
It's still not good.
Well, we'll get to whether it's not good or not, because I'm actually analyzing the data from 10 years from Paul's practice where he's been using the vaccine-friendly plan. It's not good. It's not perfect.
No, it's a lot better, for sure. I'm not criticizing him. He's trying really hard.
Yeah. No, but it's still, and he thinks that it's still too much. And so we're looking, we conclude in the second study that we need to totally revisit whether aluminum's safety use in vaccines in the pediatric schedule at all. Right. And that's an important message.
I got a question about retention. It seems to me that the way retention is kind of modeled is this: if, say, you're injected with aluminum and say half of it was excreted in the first week, the assumption is that in the second week you excrete the next half and so on. Like how do people assume that the toxins like aluminum are excreted, and what's the actual evidence in terms of some of it bound so tightly that it's hardly ever going to get eliminated?
Right. So here's the interesting thing. When you're looking at the retention issue, Mitkus et al. Actually knew and reported that in the first 24 hours, like 70% of the aluminum clears from the serum. That's clearance from the serum. That's not clearance from the body. Clearance from the serum is actually a disaster, because if you've lost 70% of your aluminum, it means it's going into tissue.
Right.
And there was a study that actually was done later on, a MOSFA study, that looked at the aluminum amount in an infant before they got hepatitis B with aluminum and 24 hours later, and they could find no detectable difference in the aluminum in the serum. Serum clearance means nothing for these metals. Same thing for mercury. And they got away with it with mercury because there weren't people around that would make a sufficiently large noise to say, I'm not concerned about mercury in the serum, nobody, or the plasma. Nobody goes to their doctor and says, doctor, my plasma hurts. It's got too much aluminum, right?
Right.
They go to their doctor and they say, I have a migraine. My kid regressed to autism. My kid's got eczema. My kid's got urticaria. My kid is having an eye disorder. There's something wrong neurologically. My kid keeps falling down. Okay. These are the complaints. My teen is in depression. She doesn't want to get out of the bed. She used to be hyperactive. You know, she used to be super active on sports and so on. It turns out that the pre-study actually taught us that a significant proportion, 5%, is still expected to be in the body in an adult male 4,000 days after injection.
That's like 10 years.
Yeah, and exactly, that's a long time, right?
Mm-hmm, so
talk about a half-life, you're talking about a half-life of like 7.5 years. So the rabbit study by Flaren et al., they actually found that only 5%, about 5% of the aluminum hydroxide injected into rabbits is removed from the body after 28 days. So we're talking about a long-term chronic exposure. And that's what I think is driving all this autoimmunity. We've got aluminum in the body, which is an adjuvant. It's still an adjuvant. Let's say you get a vaccine. I get the hepatitis B vaccine a certain day. You know, 14 days later, I get an infection of some kind. I now have an adjuvant against that infection. We didn't evolve our immunological response to these pathogens in the presence of an adjuvant. So we're hyper-immunizing against all pathogens. Let's say I get a cold virus. I get a streptococcus infection. After getting an adjuvanted vaccine, you're now also, you know, potentially immunizing against those proteins. And everybody listening would be like, so what's the problem? It's a freebie.
Right.
The problem with that is that all of these different pathogens that were in Lyme disease, the Borrelia spirochete that's in Lyme disease, these pathogens have proteins, especially a spirochete. A spirochete on the evolutionary tree is practically a human being compared to viruses and bacteria, okay? So there are proteins in the spirochetes, there's proteins in bacteria that are very, very similar to human proteins. They have peptides that are very similar, sequences of long stretches of their peptides or short stretches of their peptide that are very similar to human proteins. And therefore, the immune system is going to start thinking that some of our normal tissue is an alloantigen. It's from a pathogen, especially if our immune system is primed to attack it from an adjuvant that's present.
And so are you basically saying that adjuvants aren't really specific? They're non-biological, so they can't be specific to a particular virus. So they change your immune system, and if you're challenged by anything, it's going to impact that immune system response.
Yes, yeah, so much so that Dr. Paul actually, when he drops the aluminum-containing vaccine, one of the ones that he drops, he doesn't use, he uses a non-aluminum-containing vaccine for hip. He administers the hip vaccine on a day that the person's also getting an aluminum-containing vaccine to take advantage of the aluminum in the vaccine that was received that day, right? And so he also never gives more than one aluminum-containing vaccine per day. So we're looking at a very different schedule. And in Dr. Paul's practice, and looking at the data, the most vaccinated person in the practice has declined 47 vaccines after being offered by Dr. Paul. So we're not even looking at the CDC schedule in Dr. Paul's practice, and I'm looking at the vax data right now, and we're analyzing it. And we're seeing, I can't go into the details because it's not peer reviewed, but we're seeing massively distinct health differences, outcomes that we're studying between the vaccinated and unvaccinated. And the unvaccinated are 681 families that have opted, they're born into the practice and they've opted not to accept vaccines.
So okay. So within one practice, he's got a lot of patients who do not take vaccines, and then he's got some that take his modified schedule.
Yeah, he's got 681 that don't take the vaccines, and we've got something like 2,400 that take vaccines. Okay, so we have a large range of variation of vaccination acceptance.
Right.
And it's a really valuable resource, and we're working up the manuscript right now. I've done the data analysis. We're revisiting it, going over all the details to make sure everything's right. But, you know, there's some subtle things that we can talk about when it comes to aluminum, that we actually know that aluminum is used to induce autoimmunity in mice and rats, so that pharmaceutical products can be tested on the mice and rats to reverse them. And let me just tell you some of the conditions that are used. That aluminum hydroxide, the same exact aluminum that's used in vaccines, it's used in some mice to induce atherosclerosis. This is the heart condition, the lesions on the blood vessels of the heart. It's in other mice, it's used to help induce lupus. In other mice, in rats, it's been used to induce allergic rhinitis, hay fever. In CD1 mice, it's used to induce asthma. Okay, it's used in BLBC mice. It's used to induce GI allergies, which gastrointestinal disorder. It's used in other mice to induce rhinitis and arthritis. Okay, so the detractors of vaccine skepticism, and all science is founded on skepticism, by the way, and observation. The detractors, the vaccine risk denialists. When I first brought this to their attention in social media, they said, don't worry about it because, you know, you have to use 10 to 20,000 times the dose per body weight to induce autoimmunity. So obviously they've looked at this. So I went to the literature and I downloaded all the studies of all the mice and rat, the mouse and rat studies that induce autoimmunity in these animals using aluminum hydroxide. And I calculated the per dose per body weight dosage, okay, in the mice. And I compared that to a two-year-old getting a DTaP vaccine. And these animal models are only 5 times the amount, or 11 times, or 17 times, or 51 times, or 63 times. There's 72 doses on the vaccine schedule, and 60% of the vaccines on the vaccine schedule have aluminum. So we're well within the range of inducing autoimmunity using just math, just looking at the relative amount of the dose.
You're trying to, you know, you're using a fairly simple model, as you said, like you're looking at differences in body weight between a child and an adult, but there's a lot of differences between the body of a child and the body of an adult. You pointed out that kidney function is a lot less in a child. So you really can't use, you know, a linear adjustment. You probably have to reduce things even further for children, because they don't have the same capacity to eliminate toxins, other things like that.
Right. Well, Clark's rule is nonlinear. It's what's called an allometric scaling function. And so, you know, we're somewhere in the neighborhood of getting a pediatric dose limit that's much more reasonable than not having one. So we published this pediatric dose limit in 2018, and it has yet to be addressed by anybody else in the academic peer-reviewed literature. The reason why they won't address it, and no one will critique it, is because it's just math. We can prove that there's no pediatric dose limit. We can prove, we have proved that MITCUS is not a reliable conclusion whatsoever. Already, we've demonstrated that the adult dose, for instance, you consider the dose of, in a DTaP vaccine, and you do microgram per kilogram, the safe limit for an adult is about 140. And the actual micrograms per kilogram, and this, and the exposure for an adult is about 10 micrograms per kilogram. For a body weight percentile at 2 months, 50% body weight, the relationship is inverted, where the safe level is about 20, you know, 10 to 20 micrograms per kilogram, and the exposure is actually 115 micrograms per kilogram. So these babies are not little adults. They're not little adults, okay? And we treat them just like it's no problem whatsoever. And, you know, we're well beyond wondering if there's a problem. I'm convinced that we know that there's a problem. It is not indeterminate that vaccines can cause autoimmunity at all. Science shows us that vaccines cause autoimmunity mechanistically and plausibly in mice and rats.
I mean, vaccines are designed to modulate the immune system. So obviously, if anything goes wrong, it's likely to be an immune system problem. I just kind of makes sense. Like with the fact that you would deny that there was any possibility, not you personally, but the fact that vaccine advocates would deny that there's any possibility of an immune reaction from a product that's immunoreactive, that makes no sense at all. But I wanted to quote from a local a newspaper article I read, which was talking about how some people in Canada had taken vaccine issues to court. And the article said, the problem about taking vaccine issues to court is that it makes people think that the science is open for debate. And my jaw hit the floor at that point, because I thought science was all about debate. And I thought science was always open for debate. I mean, you might have the theory of relativity, but that doesn't mean that physicists aren't going to argue over the details, that there's still a lot of things to argue about in any area of science.
I think that the debate is far from over, and I think that history will show that this statement that the science is settled is one of the greatest mistakes ever made. It's going to be found to be one of the greatest examples of scientific hubris ever in the history of science. We're witnessing a national disaster. 54% in the United States of kids, they now have chronic illnesses that make them dependent on pharmaceutical products to stay comfortable. We have wobble chairs in schools. We have chill rooms in schools. Anxiety level, teen depression, it's all through the roof. So we're witnessing a very serious onslaught of chronic illness. Autoimmune diabetes is, you know, gone through the roof. And I just posted on Twitter a study that shows that you can induce autoimmune diabetes in mice using aluminum hydroxide. So it's not as, what I'm saying is, we know as scientists, we absolutely know what aluminum hydroxide does to a mammalian body in the presence of the right antigen source. And sometimes without the presence of any antigen source, you can get asthma in a rat or a mouse just by putting enough aluminum hydroxide. They just become immune to any dust in the air that they're breathing.
This is another aspect of modern science that I think is terribly negative, is that, you know, if you're using aluminum in the lab in order to induce disease conditions, you probably have no connection to the scientists who are developing vaccines, unless you were actually working on vaccines. You might be working on, as you said, other diseases like arthritis. So you're using aluminum to stimulate arthritis in a mouse or a rat or whatever.
Right.
Your research is not going to be known by people developing vaccines, because it's considered to be irrelevant to their work. And just as you studying arthritis, probably know nothing about vaccines. As a scientist, you just assume vaccines are safe because other scientists developed it. I mean, it's that sort of level of insularity and focus on just what you see as important. but often the things that are important to science come from outside.
There's a pervasive culture of don't rock the boat in biomedical research, okay? A seriously pervasive problem. I lived it, you know, I know all about it. If you raise your head up, it's going to get chopped off, right? Mm. Don't do too much too fast. Stretch your grant dollars out. You don't know when your next grant coming from, this kind of thing. As opposed to, you know, hey, we're trying to understand the root cause of disease. Allopathic medicine does not focus on root causes. They focus on modulating symptoms. That's all they want to do, because that's where the money is, right? So
yeah, like I think antidepressants are a good example of that. Like, even if their serotonin levels in your brain were the cause, you know, were the trigger for depression, most people who are depressed because they lost their job, family problems, they were sexually abused or whatever, right? And
teenagers are depressed because their beautiful, powerful, strong, virile young bodies are now wrecked by an HPV vaccine. That's kind of depressing.
There's a lot of things to be depressed about, but I guess my point is that even if this serotonin was important, which there seems to be a lot of debate about that, it's not going to undo the other things in your life that are making you depressed. You're an adult man and you lost your job and your wife left you and your kids hate you, the SSRI antidepressants might make you not care about that, but they're not going to make your children come back to talk to you, and they're not going to make your wife come back, and they're not going to get you a job. Yeah, and those are the things that are actually going to really change your outlook on life.
100%. So let's talk about food and water and aluminum and food and water and everything made from food and water. So
yeah, we have about 10 minutes left. So we need to be cognizant.
So in which case, I'll do this quickly and then let's play that audio. All right. Mm-hmm. So Dr. Paul Thomas.
Actually, he meant to say Dr. Paul Offit.
The Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He has a video online where he says, don't be concerned about aluminum in vaccines, because you get more aluminum from food and water and everything made of water than you'll ever get from a vaccine. Now, that's a universal statement. Regardless of your age, regardless of your body weight, you'll get more. I told you earlier that we only absorb 0.3% of aluminum from anything we eat.
Right.
So if you look at the dietary sources of aluminum in the first 6 months of life, and you correct for body weight, and you correct for the amount of absorption where you only absorb 0.3% of aluminum, but you inject 100% and it's all metabolically available, right?
Mm-hmm.
The conclusion is quite the inverse. You get far more aluminum in the first 6 months of life from vaccines than you'll ever get from water, food or water or anything made from water, including breast milk. It's an incredibly stupid thing to say, that you don't have to worry about aluminum from vaccines because it's also in the food and water. That would make any reasonable person more concerned about the doses of aluminum in vaccines, not less. It's like saying, and I believe it or not, I heard a public health faculty member from the University of Pittsburgh actually say this on the air on television, you don't have to worry about the lead in the water from the pipes in Pittsburgh because there's more in the soil and more in the paint chips in these old houses. It's an incredibly stupid thing to say. It's basically passing the buck and saying, don't worry about this source of toxin because that one's worse. You should be more concerned about the lead in the water if they're also eating paint chips and if they're also if they also have it in the soil.
Well, another famous one was there's more mercury in a tuna fish sandwich than in a vaccine that contains mercury. There's less now, but there still are some. But of course, you know, you're not injecting a tuna fish sandwich. So it's a completely spurious comparison.
It's additive. So moms were told, don't eat swordfish, don't eat tuna when you're pregnant, but go ahead and take a vaccine. Go ahead, we're going to inject your kid with a hepatitis B vaccine at the minute they step into this world with mercury before they took the mercury out. So you asked earlier about the World Health Organization. This should work where I play it right in the microphone.
Okay.
I'm going to play a segment of this. This is taken from High Wire by Del Bigtree. So you might hear Del come in and say some commentary.
Right.
My name is Marion Gruber. I'm with the Office of Vaccines at the Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research, U.S. Food and Drug Administration. And as I was reading the paper that I was part of writing, I would like to sort of underscore a few points made in that paper and also reflect on some of the issues presented to us regarding novel vaccine platforms. So I think vaccines, regardless whether they are generated using new and innovative technology or whether more standard conventional technologies are applied, they do require safety surveillance and monitoring that is specifically tailored to the vaccine that is under consideration using available pharmacovigilance systems. So in other words, the risk management plan for each particular vaccine will need to take into the consideration the pre-licensure safety database, potential safety signals that may have been identified during pre-licensure clinical safety trials, other perhaps even theoretical safety concerns, and also need to take into consideration the disease to be prevented, the target population, and the proposed indication in order to really inform risk management.
Okay, so what we're looking at there is a very serious vaccine safety science conference where they're taking issues seriously. And you were asking about adjuvants, and there's a quote here, and I'm getting the video to the point where we start to hear from this one guy who talks about adjuvants and their multiple, how they multiply reactogenicity as well as adjuvanticity.
And can we talk about reactogenicity?
Adjuvanticity is the ability of a vaccine to induce the desired reaction to induce some immunity to the pathogen proteins. Mm-hmm. Reactogenicity are the adverse events that come from vaccines. So,
and that's because you react to other things. You might develop, say, a peanut allergy or something like that. Because
correct, or you might develop a seizure or so on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay.
So let's pick this up. This is Dr. Martin Howell-Frieda.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Let me say a few words about adjuvants. So adjuvants are added to vaccines for many reasons, but primarily to make the vaccines work. And as we enter the next decade, we're trying to make vaccines against malaria, TB, HIV, GBS, RSV. It is extremely likely that these are going to require adjuvants. And yet, every time we add an adjuvant to a vaccine, the people that are using the vaccine look at it, and if there's an adverse event, we know what they're going to say. It's the adjuvant that caused that adverse event. And we've seen clinical studies in the past where a single adverse event has been blamed on the adjuvant in the development trials, and things come to a standstill while we go in and spend many years trying to investigate, is the theoretical immunostimulation induced by that adjuvant responsible for the adverse event? Now, over the years of GACS, over the last 15 years, we've seen many accusations. I'm going to begin off with aluminium. So this was accused of causing macrophagic myofasciitis. And yet, this complex word typically only occurs many years after potential administration of the aluminium. And as we go forwards with the immunostimulators like MPL, like the saponins, we are likely to see every time that there is an association, be it temporal or not temporal, the first accusation is it is the adjuvant. And yet without adjuvants, we are not going to have the next generation of vaccines. And many of the vaccines that we do have, ranging from tetanus through to HPV, require adjuvants in order for them to work. So the challenge that we have in front of us is how do we build confidence in this? And the confidence, first of all, comes from the regulatory agencies, to Marianne. When we add an adjuvant, it's because it is essential. We do not add adjuvants to vaccines because we want to do so. But when we add them, it adds to the complexity. And I give courses every year on how do you develop vaccines, how do you make vaccines? And the first lesson is, while you're making your vaccine, if you can avoid using an adjuvant, please do so. Lesson two is, if you're going to use an adjuvant, use one that has a history of safety. And lesson three is, if you're not going to do that, think very carefully.
Okay, so there you go. That was the gentleman that you were referencing. And your listeners just heard me talk for, what, an hour about the existing CDC schedule and what we're finding in terms of aluminum toxicity and how animals are given rheumatoid arthritis and lupus and all these other things using doses per body weight that are already within target of the schedule. They're going to be adding many more vaccines to the schedule. And I've been called anti-vaccine. I'm not anti-vaccine. I'm a scientist just like those guys that you just heard from. My concern is that when they unleash another adjuvant, that there's actually going to be synergistic toxicity between saponins and aluminum. And we already know they tried to think about lipopolysaccharides as an adjuvant. And it shows synergistic, it has the ability in mice to develop autism. And so if you could develop autism using an adjuvant in mice, then it's not unreasonable to expect that, you know what, maybe the adjuvant is contributing to neurodevelopmental disorders in humans. Now, as they add more vaccines to the schedule, vaccine risk awareness is going to increase. They have it backwards. They're saying that it's alleged, that there's accusations. When we do science, we don't deal with allegations and accusations and liability. We deal with initial observations. And the post-market surveillance study is where we're going to find the long-term effects of adverse events from adjuvants and from vaccines. All they have is vaccine risk denialism. So I don't know if people caught that, but what he was saying was, these are accusations, baloney. They're
right. Well, if I can comment, what I heard was he was talking about a case where you had a single adverse reaction that occurred years after the vaccine. But I think what most parents are concerned about is when a child regresses within days of a vaccine and they observe that the vaccine seems like the most obvious potential cause of that. So he seemed to be trying to minimize this as, you know, one person gets the disease 10 years after the vaccine and now we've got to stop using the vaccine. I don't really think that's the case.
No, I think he's talking about within a trial. So within a randomized clinical trial that has to come to a stop, that's within the 5 days or 4 weeks period right afterwards. So he said long-term, but he means like right at the end of the trial or something.
But he was talking about years where we have to wait before we resolve this, before we can go on. And that doesn't seem to match.
Well, it does match, because if you pause a clinical trial, it will take you years to determine what to do afterwards. So if you'd run a clinical trial with a safety window where you're tracking safety for 5 days or a few weeks, and then you find that somebody died from your drug, you have to stop the trial. And it takes years to sort out what to do next. It's not as though you can just say, oh, okay, I guess we'll just start it again and see if it starts. You're not mowing your lawn. We're actually doing human subjects experimentation. The post-market surveillance studies that are done are observational studies where the vaccines are put out on the market to see, is there a problem that emerges? And we're not seeing one problem with vaccine. Right. We're seeing hundreds of thousands of reports, initial observations of, you know, very debilitating conditions, including death. All right.
Right. So I guess my point was that if you had a clinical trial of a vaccine and you had one death from an unusual condition, I mean, from my reading of numerous scientific, you know, clinical trial articles, I think it would be declared not related to the vaccine, and life would go on, and they'd approve the vaccine or the drug or whatever.
I haven't seen that due to deaths. What I've seen that I may be wrong, but what I've seen that is due to adverse events that the clinical team has decided that clinical event isn't due to a vaccine. Mm-hmm. Why is it not due to a vaccine? Well, it's not due to a vaccine because no science has ever shown that it's due to a vaccine, so it can't be due to a vaccine. What's the point? It's so circular, right?
Yes. We're running out of time, so I wanted to give you an opportunity to tell us, you know, what IPAC is planning to do in the future. Maybe you've already told us some of what you're going to do, but can we wrap up with you telling us what your future plans at IPAC are?
Yeah, absolutely. IPAC is 100% supported by donations from the public. We're a not-for-profit registered in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. We haven't achieved 501c3 status yet because we haven't completed our application. We're at phase two of doing that. We're in the middle of applying for what I hope to be pure public charity status, but we're not there yet. So you can still donate to IPAC, but it's not a tax deduction. But nevertheless, we are doing a great study with Dr. Paul Thomas's data of vaccinated versus unvaccinated. And we're looking at it, and we designed the analysis in such a way where we control for family history, we control for prior history of autism, prior history of autoimmunity, and we also control for age differences as a potential confounder. And the signals that we're finding are so strong and so compelling that, we're going to publish in a mainstream journal. We don't know where yet, but they're going to come after it, and they're going to try to have it retracted. This is what we've seen with other studies that lead to differences.
I would be surprised if they didn't.
Of course. So we expect it. Mm-hmm. So I was just called into a potential collaboration where we may have access to data from six different practices. And so IPAC, is not just doing association studies. We're going to work to see if we can predict, given the data that we have, who among the vaccinated would have developed a serious adverse event. Because if we can predict who among the vaccinated were to develop, say, urticaria, dermatitis, ADHD, and so on, if we could predict that, then that goes a long way to convincing the pediatric population, the pediatricians, I should say, that if we can predict it, then there must be a causal relationship. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're doing next. And if you care to get behind IPAC and support what we're doing, you can always use a small monthly donation to carry us forward, ipaknowledge.org to the mm-hmm. Institute for Pure and Applied Knowledge. We don't take any money from corporations or the government. We're here to do science in the public interest and without any profit motive.
Well, thank you very much for joining me today, James. I appreciate it. It's a very interesting conversation, and this battle goes on, as we've seen in New Jersey and California, the battles over vaccine safety and the right for parents to choose is ongoing.
Yeah, absolutely it is. And if you'd like to have an IPAC Science Day, we do educational events, and I want to be perfectly clear. There is no quid pro quo expectation.
Okay. Well, that's
whatsoever.
Yes. But you will charge for the costs of the event.
No, we will not. We will ask for a suggested donation.
Okay.
Okay. We will not charge any fee. It's a suggested donation. And right. We will come to your site, and I hope to get 1,000 people in and charge them all a quarter. That'd be great.
Right.
All right.
Thank you very much for joining me today. It was great talking to you.
Great talking to you too, David. Thanks so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 241 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram @infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount to Infectious Myth on patreon.com or liberapay.com. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.